I'm Claire Strempel, managing editor of the KTOO Newsroom. In the last 6 months, we've doubled our newsroom to be fully staffed with 4 beat reporters and a morning news host. We're doing our best work to keep you connected to the news you need, to be safe, to be informed, and to be a community. Work like ours is on the line with the recent federal funding cut to public media, a third of KTOO's budget. You can help with a donation at ktoo.org. Thank you.
Listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan. It's Friday, August 8th, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher Gwyneth Cheesh, Hawa Tuksk Newsom Salama. Thank you for joining the conversation. You may also join us on our live stream on YouTube at ktoo.org/JPMLive or on KTOO's Instagram and Facebook pages. Coming up, with the U.S. Coast Guard's new polar icebreaker set to make Juneau its new home, it's a perfect time to revisit its namesake, the original Storrs icebreaker. The Alaska State Museum will have a public screening of Storrs, the galloping ghost of the Alaskan coast, this Saturday, August 9th. We explore the creation of this documentary later in the hour. But first up today, Alaska Children's Trust earlier this year named its 2025 cohort of Champions for Kids, an honor bestowed upon those who demonstrate dedication and commitment in working to ensure that children and youth are living in safe, supportive, and nurturing communities. And Juneau's own Jordan Nigro was one of 4 Alaskans selected for this distinct honor. Jordan's work with youth began in 1999 and became her life's calling. Jordan has worked for the city managing youth services and is the main driver behind the Zach Gordon Youth Center here in Juneau. She has also helped to build and expand programming and housing options for youth and loves watching young people find their voice. She also has a really strong earring game. and it's an honor to welcome back to the program Jordan Nigro. Wasa Iatikuna Cheesh for being here. How are you today?
Thank you, Boston. I'm good.
Excellent. We also have with us Kayla Pfister, Director of Community Engagement for Alaska's Children's Trust. Gwyneth Cheesh, Wasa Iati, how are you today, Kayla?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having
me. Glad that you're in Juneau for this special time and being able to be here today. So let's first start with the Children's Trust and find out what that is. It's an organization based in Anchorage, but you work statewide. Tell us a little bit about the work that you all do.
We do. So we're a nonprofit, 501c3, and our mission is the prevention of child abuse and neglect. So we do that by trying to make sure that families and communities have the knowledge, skills, supports, and resources to thrive, whether that's parenting classes like our positive Indigenous parenting training or advocacy in support of childcare and after school. We really do a broad-based approach to upstream prevention so that families never get to the point where their rubber band is stretched too thin and a case of child abuse or neglect occurs.
Is it a service that you go out and do things in the communities, or are people able to access your services?
A little bit of both. Okay. We're not really direct service. There's a couple of things that we do that are. But for example, that training I mentioned, positive Indigenous parenting, we train trainers and then they go out in their communities and they're able to give more tailored trainings to the people in their community. So like here in Juneau, the Kinship Support Program, they're one of our cohort members, and they have an implementation grant from us to go out and create a Tlingit Haida Shimshian focused version of that training. We do have some tools that are accessible for parents. Like, we have a suite of online safety tools so that parents have the kind of the beginnings of a conversation to talk about how to keep kids safe online. But for the most part, we're working with providers, we're working with after school educators, we're working with teachers to make sure they have what they need to then do their work.
Absolutely. And of course, you can go to their website, alaskachildrenstrust.org. You can find out all about that. Kinship Support Program was on the show a while back, and it was a newer program that started like last year sometime, but it's just exploded. It's really nice to see your support of that program.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So this Champions for Kids Award, tell us a little bit about what you do with this particular award.
Sure. So we know that one of the keys to children growing up safe and healthy is having supportive adults in their life. And unfortunately, for some kids, that isn't their parents, or it is, but they need an additional hand to hold. They need other people that are going to be in their court. So we realized that we, one, need to support after-school providers, because that's a huge part of kids having that extra adult in their life. And two, these people often don't get recognized for that work. There's usually not an award that goes to an after-school provider, a child care provider. So we decided to create something that really recognized individuals that often don't get that recognition. In addition, it is a fundraiser for the Children's Trust. It's our annual fundraiser. And what we do is we bring in nominations from all across the state. So I think we had like 25 or 30 this past year. And our board and our staff then goes through and decides who's going to win for that year. So we had 4 winners, and Jordan was an easy pick.
And that was my other question, was do people nominate folks for this award, or is this something that you're looking around the communities and the partners you work with and asking them for nominations?
A little bit of both. Again, we put out the nomination to the public. We send out a press release, and hopefully newspapers pick it up and put it out there. And we do get lots of just people that submit. And then we sometimes know of somebody and we're like, oh, could you put in a nomination for this person? I think they'd be a good recipient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's so cool. And it is a really fun ceremony. Like you said, it's a fundraiser for you. This happened earlier this year. I do have a couple pictures from the ceremony here. Jordan in front of her sign for Champion for Kids. And then also Jordan with her plaque award, or I guess the thing you would hang on the wall, along with one of the organizers there. And of course, you can see what I'm talking about here if you're watching the stream of Jordan's earring game. She has on a really lovely pair. Do you remember what you were wearing that night? Do you remember? They're long, dangly gold
yeah, earrings,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Juno, we were talking about before the show started, Juno just has like, you know, just an earring game that's on point, let's say.
It's true.
And we have so many people here who make earrings too. Which
yeah,
is
these
also,
are all earrings made by
yeah,
Juno.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's just so funny. So, Jordan Nigro, congratulations on this award.
Thank you, Boston.
Yeah, you, and it is true, because I feel like when you were talking about the people, Kayla, who go unrecognized, I feel like Jordan is one of those people who puts the spotlight on others, right, and makes it all about the other folks and the things that she's doing. And really, it's the youth. It's really making sure that these kids are having a place to go, having things to do. Finding their voice, as Jordan says. So let's go back to the beginning, Jordan, just a little bit. Since we're here to honor you, we'll talk about the Zach Gordon Youth Center and its work, but we're here to talk about you. And so in your bio for this award, you said that your work with youth began in 1999. Mm-hmm. We won't talk about how many years ago that was. You can do the math yourselves. Will you share about those first experiences and how it shaped the course of your life?
Yeah, you know, I came back, I grew up in Gustavus, and I went to college in Northern California, and after I finished, I was like, oh, what do I do with myself? So I kind of hung around there for a while, and then, because I graduated in 98, and then I thought, oh, I'll go back up to Alaska for the summer. And so, you know, I'm one of those people.
That old
like
trope.
Many of us. Well, I came for a summer. And I got a job working in what was then the youth shelter in town. And it was run by Juno Youth Services. And I just loved it. I just loved the teenagers. And it felt like a meaningful thing to be doing. And I loved just sitting and talking with kids about their lives and watching them kind of light up as they grew into themselves, and also just helping them to articulate back maybe to the adults in their life what they needed, and helping parents and kids kind of get on the same page about things a bit. And so I did that. I worked there at JYS for 10 years, the first several at the shelter, and then I became the director of residential services. JYS used to do, they don't exist anymore, but they used to do a lot of behavioral health residential treatment for kids. Mm. So I did that for about a decade. And then I kind of went, oh my gosh, I've been working here for 10 years and I'm like, what does this mean? I just started here out of college. I can't, you know, had a little bit of a, I can't work here forever. And I kind of wanted to see just what else was out there. And I went and worked at Southeast Alaska Independent Living. I was the deputy director there for 6 or 7 years, which I loved. That was a whole other like side of youth work and family work and, you know, looking at it more from people with disabilities perspective. And that really, I learned a lot working there and I loved it. And I also missed doing more direct work with youth. And so Joan, the executive director there, had a sabbatical and I was the acting executive director while she was on sabbatical. And before she left, I said, hey, Joan, you know, when you get back, if something opens up that seems like the right fit working with teens again, I might go back and do that. And she came back and like literally within 2 weeks of her coming back, Christy West, who was the previous manager at Zach Gordon, told me she was retiring. And I was like, oh, my gosh. The universe is like, you better go work here.
isn't that funny?
It was very weird.
Yeah.
It felt very like,
yeah.
So then I started there in 2015. So I've been at Zach for 10 years now.
So what were you doing? What was your degree in when you said you graduated from college?
My degree is in photography and political science.
Photography and political science.
Yeah.
When you were in college getting these two degrees, photography and political science, what did you think you were going to do with those?
Oh, I thought, I thought I was going to be a journalist, I think. At some point, that's what I thought. And then I just stopped thinking about what I was going to do and just took classes I liked. As I, you know, I went to a very affordable college at a time when college was still affordable. So you could do that.
Yeah, you could just take whatever classes you were
interested
in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, our
your electives, right?
My university cost $900 a semester.
Wow.
So
yeah.
It's just like times are so different, right? And we, I was very privileged to be able to just be in school and kind of do what I wanted to do. So,
is there a story from I'm still stuck on 1999 when you is there somebody you remember? Like, do you remember a moment?
Oh, there's so many kids that I remember Boston.
Yeah.
And what's really fun is most of them, not most of them, a lot of them come into Zach Gordon now with their kids.
Oh, that's so funny.
And I see them often and they'll pop in and be like, whoa, Jordan. And like, it's just really a joy. You know, kids are so much fun and teenagers are so fun and they say the funniest things. And there were a few times where it just talking with kids about what they have experienced in life and just taking the time to really listen to them and be like, what job would I ever get to do that is this like, you really like, I still do this today. Like, I get time. Like, I am by and large an administrator at this point, right? Like, I'm doing a lot of grant writing and fundraising and program development and all these kinds of things. But I still spend a lot of time directly working with kids and just sitting in my office chatting with them. And, like, I leave work and just get to be like, this is what I get. I think part of the reason that I love it so much is it's different every single day. Mm-hmm. You really get to know people on this human level and you get to know parents on a human level. And I think, you know, there are a lot of folks over the years, I've seen a lot of folks go into the world of working with kids who have a hard time with parents who are making not great decisions for their kids. Right. Mm-hmm. But for me, the longer I did the work, the more I just really feel like if you can't if you can't love the parents, you shouldn't love their kids, you know? Mm. And, like, I often find with kids who have experienced trauma, their parents have experienced that same trauma. And it's, you know, if you can sit with people and hold that in mind and just recognize that we're all just our own stuff grown up, right?
Like, well, it's funny because, you know, you think about it. I realized, I don't know what age this was, but I was like, maybe it was when I hit 40 or something. I was like, oh, adults didn't really have anything figured out either.
Exactly.
And you think you're going to get it when you're older. And then
you just don't. You're just like, oh, we're all just like trying to go along. And so I think, you know, I really enjoy working with families. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the most fun things about Zach is we get to see kids almost always like at their best because they come there, they want to be there, they're having fun, they're, mm-hmm. you know, and sometimes those same kids at school are struggling or having a harder time. And so the parents don't hear necessarily good things all the time. And it's just like such a delight to be able to say to parents when they come in, you know, I just wanted to tell you how much we love your kids around here. They're just so great. And it really, it's so much fun. Like, it's so fun to be able to say that, you know, to families and see them light up and just, you know, I think I grew up in a really small town and I really feel, I don't know, I feel really strongly that, like, that it takes a village is absolutely true. Mm. I got in trouble many times growing up because a neighbor told my parents things. You know, somebody called my dad and said, Jordan was on the ATC driving too fast around this corner. You know, like, and I think that's really important, actually. Like, yeah. I think it's important for kids to know that adults in the community care about them.
Community is so important. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. We're talking with Jordan Nigro and Kayla Pfister. Jordan was awarded the Champion of Kids Award from the Alaska Children's Trust earlier this year. And, you know, it's interesting when you were talking about the work you do now, Jordan, as an administrator, you do a lot of, you know, that the trajectory happens where you mm-hmm. start in the doing the work and then you end mm-hmm. up running the thing mm-hmm. and doing all the hard stuff. But, you know, and I realized, oh, well, you were out of college. And so you were, like, were you – I'm imagining that you went to college around the age you would go to college.
Yeah, I was 22.
So you were, like, late 20s? 20. So you were starting to work with kids.
I was a baby.
They weren't that much younger than
you. They were not much younger than me. The first family, like, quote-unquote mediation I did, I got, like, tossed in a room with these two parents and this teenage girl that were not getting along at all. And it was basically like – good luck. And I remember sitting there thinking, I don't know how to do this.
I have a political science degree.
Jeez, like, why am I here, you know?
Yeah.
But really, it's just about relationships, you know? And like, that particular mom, I still see her. I talk to her.
Wow.
She's called me to, like, ask questions about how we've, like, launched certain initiatives and things and from the community that she lives in now, and I ask about her kids, and, you know, I mean, like, this is like such a gift, right? Like, such a cool thing. So.
You must be really a very good mediator for her to come back with that.
Well, I'm imagining that.
I don't
you know
if I was then. Might be better now.
The difference between then and now is probably huge, and you've done so much. And like you said, you went to work for the city in 2015, sort of mm-hmm. managing the youth services, managing the youth mm-hmm. center. The Zach Gordon Youth Center. Can you give us a picture of what it was like when you first started there? Because I know there's so much that you've done with the organization. There's so many things happening with it now. But what was it like when you first started in 2015?
Yeah, so, you know, Zach Gordon has always been a super special place in this community. Mm-hmm. We are just coming up on 80 years of being in existence.
Wow.
And the facility itself has just a real long history of being an inclusive space. When you know, places in Juneau were excluding Native folks and very, like, super racist stuff going on. And so, but Zach Gordon, who started the place, was like, hey, there needs to be a place for teens. And so, you know, it became a place for everyone. It was a very inclusive space for teens, which is another really awesome thing because people elders will pop in. And Fran Houston was just over talking with our camp.
That's great.
And, you know, she knew Zach Gordon and she loves to talk about him. And so that's a real treasure. But one of the things I noticed as soon as I started is we had kids coming in who were homeless or, you know, had run away from home and didn't have a place to stay for that night. And at the time, there was a JYS's shelter was really pretty limited in what they were able to provide. And not long after that, they closed the shelter. And so, you know, then I kind of was like, hey, community, someone needs to open a youth shelter. Mm-hmm. And the community kind of said back to us, well, we think you guys should do it because the kids are already coming to us. You know, we know them and we mm-hmm. see them every day. And so in 2021, in July of 21, we opened Shay Hat Hit, which is a shelter for youth ages 10 through 17. So there's temporary shelter. It's a 6-bed temporary shelter. We also have transitional living beds. So attached, we have an apartment for 18 to 21-year-olds, and they can stay in that apartment for up to 2 years. But mostly they're there for 9 months.
Wow.
And it's just, you know, transition them into adulthood. And then we also have a rapid rehousing program, which is funded by HUD, and it's in the community for youth 18 to 25, where the rental assistance is provided through a grant, and we provide the supportive services. All of our housing programs, all three of those programs, are a partnership with Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority.
Okay.
So for the building itself, they provide the property management. Mm. So if something breaks, we don't call the city, we call the housing authority, and they come and fix it. And then for the rapid rehousing program, they are the actual recipients of the HUD grant, and they send the rent checks to the landlords. We do all the direct service, but they've been just wonderful partners, and that's been a real treat too, is just to do this work. It's my feeling that, you know, when we do these kind of heavy lifts, like creating housing programs and things like that, the more they can be done in partnership, the mm-hmm. better, because then everybody is taking a bit of it. And also, I think for the young people coming in, they know that, you know, and they know that all of these organizations believe in supporting them and the community is there for them. And I think that, I really think it matters. I think it makes a big difference. We also have, we just started this last year, housing or after school programs in Douglas. Mm. So those are funded by the by AHFC, and they're at Geneva Woods and Cedar Park, and we did a summer program there too. And then we have the BAM after school program, which is at Thunder Mountain, and it's free after school activities. So all of our programs are free.
How many? I love the housing options, and there's a variety of those. And how many youth do you feel? Is there numbers of people that you've helped?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, are you keeping track of this?
We served close to 1,500 individual kids at Zach Gordon last year in 2024. The shelter numbers are smaller than that. It's more like, I think, 60 youth or something like that. And then in rapid rehousing, I think it was 16 youth last year.
What is the rapid rehousing? Can you explain that a little bit more for me?
So rapid rehousing is for youth who are either homeless or at imminent risk of homelessness.
Okay.
So they can come into us. They are often referred. Sometimes they just show up and tell us, we need a place to live. And what we do is work with them, our navigators. We have two navigators on staff, and they work with the youth to find a place to live in the community. So if there's any private landlords listening that ever want to, you know, rent to a young person, we're always looking for landlords. That's the hardest part of this program, because Juneau, as we all know, does
very
not
difficult.
Have much affordable housing.
Yeah.
So we need to find a place that's affordable and a landlord that is willing to work with a young person. The rent is guaranteed for up to 2 years. And we have different rapid rehousing programs work differently. How ours works is we provide 100% of the rent up front. And then if that young person gets a job, we work with them to see what part of rent they can kick in. And if they lose their job, then we go back to 100% of rent. Instead of like some programs are like, we'll provide 100% for 3 months, but then it goes down and then it, you know. Mm-hmm. But that's not usually life with young people. They might get a job for a little bit, lose the job or quit the job, you know, can go back and forth. So we try to be flexible with where the young person is at.
There's so much that goes on over there. And the easiest way to get to the website and stuff is just put it in your favorite search engine, Zach mm-hmm. Gordon Youth Center. Mm-hmm. And you can see all the different programs and stuff. How do kids and folks and young adults access Zach Gordon? Is it the easiest thing to do is drop in? Is it, do you have to make an appointment?
Nope, you can just drop in. Our navigators, if you're looking for supportive services, our navigators are there Monday through Friday, 10 to 6 pretty much. And sometimes they're out running around because they're also checking in with the young people that are in rapid rehousing. Mm-hmm. So it helps to call, but you can always just come by. And Zach is open 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Thursday. And then Friday, it's 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. Saturday, it's 3 p.m. to 10 p.m. And we're closed on Sundays. And when school starts, which is shockingly next week.
Very soon.
Very, very soon. Because we run summer camps and all that kind of thing, too. When school starts, we go to basically after school hours if you're enrolled in school. So if you show up and you are a student, you can't hang out at Zach and skip school. We'll send you back to school. We do sometimes have kids come in who, you know, something happened at school and they left and we might be like, okay, well, let's have a cup of tea or make a sandwich and then can we get you back
to school?
Chat about
it. Yeah. And of course, these services are of no cost.
Yep. That's all. It's all free. The camps have a nominal cost, but we have a scholarship program that we've worked really hard with Juno Community Foundation to really increase the amount. So we can scholarship pretty much any kid that needs it. And those scholarships are also available for young people to take part in any activities in the community.
And there's things going on there all the time. I mean, you can look at the calendar. There's like D&D nights
yep.
and there's activities and yep. different things going on. It's not just the rapid rehousing program. And
we did
like that.
Two overnight camping trips this summer, which
overnight.
Were our first
oh,
time
cool.
we've done this. We took a group of teens out to Amalga Cabin for the night, and we took a group of elementary students out to Eagle Valley Center for a night. Both of them were really fun.
Wow. Well, Kayla, you can see I can see why maybe that Jordan got this award, Champion of Kids Award from Alaska Children's Trust. It's such a cool way to highlight and to sort of, you know, promote those who have who are doing this work. And I know you're the face of the organization, Jordan. I know you have tons of counselors and workers and people who are there. Do you want to shout out your staff a little bit?
Yeah, that's what I was actually just about to say. Hey, Boston, like, truthfully, like, none of this would happen without our staff.
Yeah.
Like, we have amazing staff, and I feel so, I'm constantly like, I go home and, you know, my husband has a very serious office job and I come home and I'm like, well, everyone was singing karaoke when I left work today and the staff did this and they did that and da-da-da-da-da. Like, I just feel super, like, this is the best place I've ever been in my career as far as, like, the team that I get to work with, the flexibility of what we can do to meet kids really where they're at and to just, you know, be in community with them.
It's very cool. Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing a little bit about your history and the work that's going on there. I did want to mention it's an event you're doing in conjunction with JAMI Health and
yep.
Wellness this weekend. It's a back to school because, like you said,
yep, school's next week.
Start next week. It's at 3 p.m. on Saturday. It looks like there's going to be all kinds of. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what's going
on?
Yeah,
we are doing JAMI's 40th anniversary is happening this year, and they're doing a series of kind of give backs to the community. So very kindly, they chose us as one of the organizations they wanted to do some give back to. So they're doing, actually in the morning, they're doing a gardening thing out at the shelter. They're going to plant some things for us for next spring.
Oh, cool.
Which is really sweet. That event is not public, but I just want to shout out because it's really great and helpful that they're doing that for us. We really needed that help. And then at Zach tomorrow from 3 to 6, there's going to be a DJ there. Alaska ACS donated backpacks to us earlier this summer that are all stuffed with school supplies. And so Jammy staff are going to come and help us do some harvesting in the garden. They're bringing a DJ. We're going to barbecue. We're going to give away backpacks. Hopefully
cool.
the weather will cooperate. But yeah, we really appreciate Jammy for thinking of us.
And the DJ is our very own KXLL's Kelly Icardi is going to be the DJ tomorrow.
You are more in the loop than me.
That's kind of fun. And that's it. That's Jammy's event. You can check it out more at Jammy's website, J-A-M-H-I. You can put that in your favorite search engine and learn more a little bit about that event happening tomorrow. And you can, again, you can go to alaskachildrenstrust.org for more information on the organization that bestowed this honor upon our very own Jordan Nigro.
Yeah, and there are three other honorees that are pretty incredible. It was really humbling to be nominated with them. So I would encourage you, if you do go to that website, to read through the other nominees because they're some awesome women doing amazing work around
and it's
the
stuff, and it's a thing that happens every year. And so you can go and find out and maybe learn how to nominate. You can reach out. And when do nominations open for that?
We'll probably open nominations in December or January this year. So that'll be right on our website and hopefully in the paper as well.
I appreciate that. Well, Jordan Nigro, Kayla Pfister, thank you so much, Gunnath Cheese, for being here today.
Thank you, Boston.
Okay, up next, it's this week's Our Living Lands from Native Voice One. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As rising seas threaten many indigenous communities, two villages in Alaska's Kenai Peninsula are considering a project that would harness the power of ocean waves for much-needed energy. Ayulna Naiden with the Alaska Desk has more.
Waves gently hit the shores of Kachemak Bay as ravens croak above on a cloudy night in July. The small village of Port Graham is nested here at the southern tip of the Kenai Peninsula. The village has recently started to look at waves a little differently and may soon convert wave energy into electricity. Danielle Malchev is the first chief of Port Graham.
Energy through waves, it's convenient for us because that energy source is coming from our ocean.
I have a lot of hope that this is going to be something great for our community.
Chugachmut is a consortium that serves native tribes in South Central, including Port Graham and its neighbor, Nanwalik. The consortium announced it had partnered with an Australia-based company, Carnegie Clean Energy, in May to explore an ocean wave energy project for both villages. The initiative is years away and would cost more than $100 million in total, but it could be a new way for coastal villages to get reliable electricity at a lower cost. Carnegie has several wave energy projects across the world, including Australia and Spain, but this would be the company's first commercial installment in the U.S. That's according to Louise Richardson, Carnegie's commercial analyst. Richardson said, as Port Graham and Nanwalik might be perfect candidates for the installment because of their location.
One thing at Carnegie that we hope our technology will be able to service in the future is remote communities and isolated communities that might not have access to other forms of renewable energy options.
Port Graham and Nanwalik have no roads connecting them to the rest of the state. Energy costs there are high because the villages are at the edge of the grid and diesel for a backup generator comes on a barge. Plus, according to Chugachmut, the electrical lines running from Homer are several decades old, don't have enough capacity, and are unreliable. Malchev with Port Graham says the village loses power several times a month in winter and once every few months in summer.
Without power, we cannot make those connections to the people outside of our village. And this strains us in so many aspects, just in our normal lives.
Malchev previously worked as a health aide and is now a community health representative for the village. She says outages also make work at the clinic harder.
Say we had an emergency and we have to use satellite phones if our power is out, which isn't very convenient when you're trying to relay and talk to doctors in the ER and you're dealing with a patient at that time.
Malchev says more reliable electricity from wave energy could solve some of those issues. And ideally, the villages can sell any extra energy back to the grid and use that revenue on healthcare and education. The plan is to place a wave energy device offshore from Port Graham by Flat and East Chugach Islands. The device will be submerged and tethered to the seabed, moving with the waves and converting power from that motion into electricity. Villages on shore would receive the electricity through underwater cables.
That's what we need for our communities, because it generates its own power
Phyllis Wimberly is the deputy director at Chugachmyut. She says the first step is to ensure the location will work for the project. Wimberly says the consortium is planning to install test buoys by September. The villages will also need to upgrade their electrical system to increase capacity and have a way to plug into the wave energy unit. Wimberly says the consortium plans to invest $60,000 into the first stage of the project. They are also working to get additional funding from other sources. One federal grant they applied for was terminated in May, but Wimberly says Chugachmyut will continue its search.
Every time you go down a pathway and it's blocked, you have to go around. You have to go do something else. We're going to never give up.
Meanwhile, Wimberly says permitting, testing, and installation of the project might take close to 5 years. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naidin.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com.
For just one time, I would take the Northwest Passage to find the hand of Franklin reaching for the Beaufort Sea, tracing one warm line through a land so wide and savage, and make a Northwest Passage to the sea. Westward from the Davis Strait is there, 'twas said to lie, the sea route to the Orient for which so many died, seeking gold and glory, leaving weathered broken bones and a long forgotten lonely cairn of stones. For just one.
That's a little Stan Rogers, Northwest Passage. You are listening to Community Supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. In honor of the commissioning of the new U.S. Coast Guard cutter Storis, which is in Juneau this weekend, FYI, you can read a story about it on KTO's homepage, and there's a christening set for Sunday morning in downtown Juneau. But this Storis isn't the original Storis. The Alaska State Library Archives and Museum is going to host a free screening of the documentary film Storis, The Galloping Ghost of the Alaskan Coast, which I just love that name, with filmmaker and also happens to work at the Alaska That's State right. Library as the archivist. Damon Stubner is here. The film is about the 64-year history of the original U.S. CGC Storis and examines its role in World War II, the Cold War, and its other relevant Alaskan history, which includes a reason we played that song, which Damon will get to here in just a second.
Yes.
Damon joins me now in Studio 2K to talk about this film. Gunnith Cheesh, welcome, Wasiati. How are you today, Damon?
Thank you. Good, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. So let's talk about first, I guess I had to look this up because with this new ship coming in, I had to look up what a cutter was, and then I had to look up, is a cutter an icebreaker? And I found out that a cutter can be an icebreaker, yeah. But an icebreaker may not be a cutter.
That is correct. Yeah, before I started the documentary, I knew tidbits of Coast Guard history and their terminology, and since then I've learned so much more. A cutter is just their word for a ship. A cutter can be, as you said, an icebreaker. It can be a ship that maintains the buoys and navigational aids, you know, hence a buoy tender. It can be a law enforcement ship. It can be any number of different things, but a cutter is just their word for their ships and their fleet.
Here's a little bit of a tidbit that I found out, thanks to Wikipedia, but it says, historically, the term cutter referred to any vessel with a permanently assigned crew in the Revenue Cutter Service, established by Alexander Hamilton in 1790 to enforce custom laws.
Yes.
And now the name has persisted as vessels evolved into longer steel-hulled ships with modern capabilities.
Yes, well, that's because the Revenue Cutter Service is the precursor to the modern-day Coast Guard.
Yeah.
The modern-day Coast Guard is actually an amalgamation of a number of different federal agencies over the centuries. The Revenue Cutter Service, its initial mission was to serve as the law enforcement arm of the new United States of America, followed by in the 1930s and a little bit shortly afterwards came the addition of the U.S. Life Saving Service, followed by the U.S. Lighthouse Service. So that's kind of the reason why the U.S. Coast Guard has all these different missions, is because over the years, Congress has kept just merging all these different agencies together.
That's really cool. Okay, so what inspired you to make this documentary?
Before making the documentary, I will be completely honest, I had really no understanding of the Coast Guard cutter Storrs, and it was one snowy evening back in 2008, one of my neighbors walked up to me and said that he was working with a group of local business and civic leaders and a group of Coast Guard veterans, and they were trying to save an old military ship from the scrapyard. And he thought that I would be a good person to produce a documentary about it. And my very first reaction was, thanks, I don't have the time. I just bought a house.
Right.
he kept insisting, like every time I bumped into him, he was like, did you look it up? You really should look it up. Did you look it up? And finally, I relented and I said, okay, I'll look up its history. If there's anything there that I can work with, I'll do it. If not, then we'll drop it. And he was like, fine, you won't regret it.
Right.
And I think maybe at the time was like, I don't know about that. And once I started looking it up, I actually learned it was just there was just so much history there, and working a video, there was also so much visual history.
Right, that's really cool. Now this film is playing tomorrow at 1 p.m.
Yes,
Saturday, August 9th. It's going to be in the main room, right?
The lecture hall there at the State Museum building. Yes.
Will you be talking as well a little bit about it?
I'll give a brief talk in the beginning, and then we'll go into the documentary, and then at the end we'll have some time for discussion. And usually, like every place that I've ever screened it in Alaska, there is always someone who had a connection to the ship.
Right.
So I'm hoping that there will be people who'll be able to share their memories and their recollections of it. It's just when it was actually serving here in Alaska, it was everywhere. Its patrol range was from Puget Sound in Washington all the way up to the high Arctic.
Wow.
So it was a kind of an unusual ship.
Now, I know that it had a lot of things it did. It did law enforcement. It did
yes.
some ice breaking. It did various different things. And you go into all of that in the film. But let's talk about the relationship to this song that we played, Northwest Passage by Stan Rogers. Tell me a little bit about how the ship was involved with that.
In the 1950s, the United States government and the Canadian government had this Cold War project to build this line of early warning radar sites all across the Arctic Circle. The United States Navy and the Canadian Navy, they were sending mass numbers of cargo ships up to the Arctic Circle, to the Arctic Ocean, to help build these radar sites. Storrs actually had numerous assignments to help map the Arctic in the advancement of all these cargo ships. There was a point in 1957 when a number of these cargo ships got trapped by ice. And so the United States Navy was kind of in a desperate situation that they really needed to find an escape route from the Pacific, from the Pacific region of the Arctic to the Atlantic region of the Arctic. So Storrs, along with two other Coast Guard cutters, the Bramble and the Spar, had the assignment to find and map a usable navigational route across the Arctic.
Wow, that's
so
amazing.
These three ships became the first U.S. ships to circumnavigate not only the North American continent, but also cross the Northwest Passage. And it was actually kind of not an easy assignment. They were pretty much charting in uncharted waters. They ran aground a couple times. They got locked in ice. A few crews got lost in fog. I mean, it was not an easy mission for them to do, particularly not in the 1950s. They were pretty much all alone on their own.
Do you go into that in the film?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And then also, it was involved in helping to create the pipeline too, right?
Yes. I briefly mentioned the pipeline, but Yeah, it was actually a support ship for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. It was doing some ice-breaking work to get barges up to Prudhoe Bay.
Interesting. And what's its connection to World War II?
It was actually built in anticipation for World War II.
They
started construction on the ship months before the attack on Pearl Harbor. It was a time period when Europe was being invaded by Nazi Germany. There was fears that Nazi Germany was going to occupy Greenland. There was the establishment of the Lend-Lease with England. So the United States government needed a series of icebreakers to help maintain and patrol around Greenland to prevent Nazi Germany from occupying it. So that was one of its very first missions, was actually patrolling the North Atlantic during World War II. It did escort duties, and then it was on the assignment to actually find and capture Nazi spies in Greenland.
Oh my gosh. Now, when did its start to decline in service?
That was about in the 1990s. It was at that point the Storrs was kind of getting up in age. I mean, after all, it was built during World War II,
yeah,
and it was continuing through service. There was starting to be some issues of structural integrity, because it was constantly up here in these northern waters, the North Atlantic, North Pacific, the Arctic Ocean. It was ice breaking.
Mm.
So there was starting to become some structural issues with it. So they started to slowly curtail some of those emissions back. And there was actually a point where in the early 2000s, where it was starting to just become too expensive to maintain the ship.
Yeah, right. At some point, it becomes a more cost.
Yeah,
to keep it up, right?
Yeah. The interesting thing about that is when Storrs was built during World War II, it was the only ship of its design and class. So There was no other ships that the Coast Guard could cannibalize for parts. So anytime something broke on the Storrs, those parts had to be custom made. And it is amazing that they were able to keep the ship in service for 64 and a half years.
Wow. And it was decommissioned in 2007.
It was decommissioned in 2007 in Kodiak. It had spent, other than World War II in the North Atlantic, it had spent its entire time up here in Alaska. It was based in Juneau for 9 years immediately after World War II. And then after the Northwest Passage expedition, it was then transferred to Kodiak, where it remained for an entire time.
Is it still is it docked somewhere, or is it?
No, sadly, in 2013, Storrs was sold for scrap and was actually shipbroken in Mexico. It was a very controversial issue at the time.
Mm.
Just a number of years before Storrs was decommissioned, there were plans to make the ship into a maritime museum. There were a number of historical societies and veterans organizations that had worked to try to get the ship made into a maritime museum. Unfortunately, in 2013,
Didn't happen.
It didn't happen. There was a someone who bought the ship on auction, and a number of different historical societies and veterans organizations tried to negotiate with him, and unfortunately, those negotiations broke down, and the ship was sent to Mexico.
Because, you know, it's cool. I've been on some of those ships where they're just docked for good, and you just go and you visit them. Like in New York, they have a couple of those. And like because it was such a unique ship, like you said, sort of a lot of custom parts and had such a storied history, especially for Alaska, that would have been really cool to be able to have, you know, it docked somewhere permanently.
Yeah, my wife, Rebecca, who helped me with the documentary, we actually got a tour of the ship in the in the California Mothball Fleet. This is at the time, it was essentially a floating graveyard of old decommissioned military and merchant reserve ships. So we actually
Is that the picture I have of you here on the stream? If you're tuning into YouTube, Facebook, or Instagram, you can see Damon on the bow of another ship, and it's the graveyard of ships over there.
Yeah, that was actually the aft of the Storrs.
I see. Oh, okay.
It was kind of interesting when we were there in the shipyard. We were kind of ferried out by a small boat to where all these ships were tied up together, and we had to climb up a ladder to get onto this U.S. Navy submarine tender, and it was a catamaran, so we had to walk across the superstructure of the catamaran and then climb down onto onto the Storrs. And just on the other side of the Storrs, there were two other Coast Guard cutters that had served in Alaska. It was the Plane Tree and the Iris. So it was
interesting.
Yeah, interesting, just as you said, just walking around the Storrs, because at that time, before it was sent to scrap, it kind of was a time capsule of the last crew. As we were walking through the ship, there was no power, so we were walking through with flashlights and headlamps. We had on our party was a Coast Guard veteran from the 1950s who was on the Northwest Passage Expedition, someone whose father was one of the captains of the Storrs during World War II, and there was a number of active serving Coast Guardsmen who actually had served on the Storrs shortly before she was decommissioned. So it was kind of interesting walking around, hearing their stories, and just seeing what was actually left behind, and sadly all that stuff went for scrap.
Well, the film is playing tomorrow. I have a couple pictures here. One in black and white, one's in color of the Storrs. The film is playing tomorrow. It is going to be at the museum. It's a free showing.
Yes.
There's no charge for this. It's tomorrow, Saturday, August 9th at 1 p.m. In the lecture hall over at the State Museum. It's going to be really interesting. And you finished this film like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's fun to have it back because of this new Storrs. Do you know why this one is – are they just honoring the original Storrs by renaming this one?
I think so. I don't actually know the full story as to why they renamed it the Storrs.
That's interesting.
But yeah, it is to be commissioned this coming weekend.
Yeah, it's on Sunday morning. There were tours of it, I think, last night and this morning. They will be coming into downtown this weekend, so you'll see it out there. The giant ship. Most of these cutters are over 65 feet long. Eventually, this new Storrs will make its home here in Juneau. And have a crew of like 190 people or something and their families making their way to Juneau to be here. It's a really interesting history about what cutters do, how the Coast Guard uses them, and especially like we talked about at the beginning of the interview, if a cutter is an icebreaker, but cutter can be an icebreaker, but an icebreaker isn't necessarily a cutter, I guess. So it's kind of interesting just to learn that bit of history for myself. And then if you want to learn about the original cutter and the Storrs, and what's the subtitle? The Galloping Ghost of the Alaskan Coast. Does that the Galloping Ghost have a history to it?
Yeah, there was at one point Storrs was very heavily involved in commercial fishery law enforcement, mostly trying to push out foreign fish pirates, Russian and Japanese, you know, fishermen who were coming illegally into the U.S. waters. Storrs was involved in a very heavily, very contentious law enforcement case that that earned it the title of the Galloping Ghost of the Alaskan Coast.
I love that.
So, and then later on, Storrs earned another title, Queen of the Fleet, as being the longest-serving commissioned Coast Guard cutter in the fleet.
I love that. That's so cool. Well, you can check out the full film tomorrow, Storrs, the Galloping Ghost of the Alaskan Coast. It's at the State Museum at 1 o'clock on Saturday. Damon Steubner, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it. Gunnath Cheesh.
Thank you.
We're going to listen to a little bit of Erin Heist, her song Another Rainy Day, in celebration of Erin being named an innovator in the arts. She got an arts award, the Kathy Colkhurst Ruddy Award for the Arts, which were recently announced, and she won the award for innovation in the arts for Trollfest, as well as a bunch of other things. Here's Erin Heist's song Another Rainy Day on Juno Afternoon.
Say goodbye to the sun. She won't be back for a while. And goodbye to you. You had to be going your way.
Erin Heist with Another Rainy Day. Congrats on the award that she won, Innovation in the Arts, from the Kathy Colkhurst Ruddy Awards through the Jack. This is Juno Afternoon. It airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. You can find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. Live stream archives on YouTube. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Erin Tripp. Gunnath Cheesh, have a fantastic weekend, everybody.